from our perspective, for religious, for folks who grew up in conservative fundamentalist religious communities, talking about sexuality in and of itself moves you a little bit out of the church community and kind of puts you in that choice dilemma.
Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Hello, Judy, and hello, listeners. Those of you who are followers of us a long time will notice, hey, where'd the video go? I'm not going to go in and there back and forth about how come, but I will simply say, turns out, and many of you know this, a lot of the platforms, such as Spotify, for example, don't carry the video, and they don't carry the audio if there's video. So we were kind of frozen out, and I'm realizing, let's just try the
back to audio.
And so here you are, folks.
Here we are.
You're listening to us, not seeing us. If you want to see our smiling faces, do go to our website, which is ctn7, that's the number 7, ctn7.com, and you get all kinds of pictures, plus access to all of our previous videos where you get to see us in action. So you can just imagine us sitting here and, you know, looking like we have always looked before.
There you go.
We've got some exciting news today. First of all, before we even do that, let's say what the title of this episode is.
Yes, so today's episode is called Sex Vangelicals, an interview with Julia Postema and Jeremiah Gibson.
Right, and that, we finished the interview and they are fascinating folks.
Yes, so Sex Vangelicals comes from the fact that they both came out of Christian evangelical backgrounds.
And became sex therapists.
And have became sex therapists.
And are no longer part of the of their evangelical backgrounds, but fascinating folks. And we had a really
wonderful
interesting conversation.
Couple. Wonderful couple. Have a lot of great things to say.
So we will be getting to that interview in just a little while. Mm-hmm. But first,
the exciting news.
The exciting news. Folks, those of you who are on my mailing list will already know this. My book, my most recent book.
It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
Well, that book came out and the Kindle version was released back on January 15th, a couple of weeks before we're making this podcast. And it hit number one bestseller in one of its categories, in couples and family therapy. Mm-hmm. It's in top 10 in several other categories. Mm-hmm. And I was flabbergasted when I saw that number one. I never would have thought that would be possible. And that is so cool.
It is cool.
I do want to invite you to check it out. You can get it in paperback. You can get it as ebook from the Amazon site. You can get it as an audiobook that also is from the Amazon site. Paperback you can get from any place. If you go to my website, brucechalmer.com, you will see easy links to get it in any of those forms. But number one bestseller, folks.
Yeah, and that is so exciting. So thank you to all of our friends, listeners, clients, everybody who's been buying the book.
And all these people have been buying it whom I don't know, which is kind of amazing.
It's so also good, too.
Yeah, it's like the word's getting around because it turns out, who knew, it's a good book. It actually is an interesting book.
And people have been writing with good reviews for it. So we would love to have your review and would love to hear your feedback.
So there is that. We also want to put in a plug for the podcast itself. Let folks know about ctn7.com. That's our website. And please rate us and follow us and whatever the heck else you do with podcasts these days to
like
indicate.
Share it.
Yep, all that stuff.
All that stuff. And you also let folks know about your newsletter.
Yes, I have a newsletter, Dr. Chalmers newsletter, which if you go to the aforementioned website, ctn7.com, a box will magically appear before your eyes. I like to tell people it's worth going to the website just to see that box appear. It grows before you. I'm so too easily impressed, aren't I? Old guy that I am. In any case, please go to that website and you can sign up for the newsletter. There have been three issues so far. There's an archive that you get with the newsletter so you can read the read all three of them. I especially suggest you read the first one, which kind of sets the whole thing up. Mm-hmm. And when you sign up for that, you will get that. And I don't send you massive amounts of emails. I think it's about, the newsletter is coming out about every other week.
Yeah.
So two times a month, maybe the occasional month it would be more, but not much. So with that, let us go to our interview. You'll hear Judy introducing our guests, Julia Postuma and Jeremiah Gibson, and we will see you on the other side.
Our guests today are Julia Postuma and Jeremiah Gibson, the co-hosts of the podcast Sex Evangelicals, the sex education the church didn't want you to have. Julia and Jeremiah are both Boston-based licensed psychotherapists and certified sex therapists who work with clients in Massachusetts. They currently live in Utrecht, the Netherlands. They specialize in helping couples with negative religious backgrounds discover sexuality that works for their partnership. They enjoy traveling to places that tend to fly under the radar, long-distance hiking, cooking very spicy food, unexpected conversations, and introverted days filled with reading and drinking fancy tea. Julia and Jeremiah, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 words.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's good to be on the podcast.
Why don't you tell us about your journeys and how you went from your backgrounds to becoming sex therapists?
Yeah. Well, so let's start with the podcast. Sex Evangelicals, as you mentioned, is the podcast about the sex education that the church didn't want you to have. So Julia and I met 4.5 years ago through a professional connection at a coffee shop in Quincy, Massachusetts. So I work in Quincy, which is just south of Boston. And at the time, we were both sex therapists in private practice in Boston, focusing primarily on work with couples and with families. Boston is lucky to have a plethora of fantastic certified sex therapists, but there's not many of them who understand the fundamentalist religious world and the impacts on relationships and sexuality.
So when we met each other, very quickly, we learned that we had fairly similar religious backgrounds, which of course informed the way that we developed as individuals and then also informed our therapy practices too. And when you grow up in what we might call high control or fundamentalist religious communities, and then you meet someone who I intentionally say survived that world, you have this instant bond with them over all these strange, bizarre, quirky kinds of experiences like purity rings and pledges and the myriad of books about marriage and sex that you greedily consume as an eager 15-year-old, and then you learn as a 25 and 35 and 45-year-old really impacted you in some pretty harmful ways.
Wow. Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, I was thinking in listening to your, I've listened to some of your podcasts, of course, and you're talking about it. You do have that sense of insider knowledge, which I got to imagine is super useful for, you know, clients coming to you, because you can understand not just the words themselves, but sort of you can understand the whole culture underneath it. Does that inform your practice a lot?
Absolutely. Yes. And clients tend to find that very comforting. We always, each therapist, I should say, practices with care in what they choose to disclose or not disclose. And everybody has a different philosophy around that. So I'm judicious about what I say. However, I do share parts of my story with clients, and that one can help foster the therapeutic relationship. And it puts them at ease that they don't need to educate me as much. And I have had some phenomenal therapists that didn't necessarily understand my world. And it does feel so isolating to try and describe how the long-term cumulative impact of a very restrictive community can so harmfully shape you.
There's also, Bruce, tied into Julia, what you're saying, this idea that in fundamentalist communities, there's this binary between us and them. And evangelical Christianity particularly is rooted in the idea that the outside world is bad, that human nature is bad, that human nature is sinful. And as such, it's easy to have a hard time trusting people who don't fit into the religious structures. That's like part of the language that happens. So knowing that Julia and I both have experience in the fundamentalist communities and have some knowledge of the language, some knowledge of the structures, that also helps to create trust as well.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. I'll give an example that might be helpful. I remember talking with a couple, and this was a male and female couple, and the woman said, told a story about writing letters to her future husband when she was young, like 10 or 11. And I had a journal that I wrote when I was equally as young to my future husband. And that's one of those both simultaneously really hilarious, but also pretty dark if you actually consider the implications of it. Mm. And to know, to have my client hear from me, I get that. I also had a journal of letters when I was very, very young to a person I didn't know. That's such an isolating thing to describe, and to know that someone has had some version of it can be comforting.
Sure. Yeah. Can you talk to us a little bit about what purity culture is?
Yeah. So purity culture, in summary, is a movement that happened in the 80s. It started in the late 70s, but moved into the 80s with the Reagan administration, where a group of evangelical churches, so churches, this actually starts in the West Coast in California and then kind of moves its way south, where these churches begin to figure out, okay, like how can we use some of our religiously informed values to influence politics? Jerry Falwell is a part of this. Jerry Falwell Jr. continues this in Liberty. This is that type of community. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that happens then in the late 80s and in the early 90s are these church communities working together to develop curriculum around sex education that's rooted in abstinence-only education.
Mm. So I remember those debates. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And actually, in the early 90s, there is a really big march on Capitol Hill where you have hundreds of thousands of teenagers that sign these purity pledges and then place them like in... I don't know, so somewhere in Washington, D.C. And not too long after that, President Clinton signs a bill that provides a lot of funding to groups and to states to provide abstinence-only education.
Well, I didn't realize Bill Clinton did that.
Yeah.
Wow. People.
Right. So that happens in the early 90s. So then you have all this funding, then that all this money that's available to do abstinence-only types of education. And so in the mid to late 90s and the 2000s, then this movement begins to take off. There's all of this content then that gets developed that talks about the benefits, quote, of waiting to have sex until you get married. And the evangelical church, the churches themselves, and then also these kind of proxy nonprofits, then become the greatest creators of this. So this is where you get focused on the family, in the early to mid 90s. That's where they get a lot of their stuff. There's a couple of companies in Grand Rapids, Michigan. There's some companies in Nashville, Tennessee. So that's kind of the summary of purity culture then is in the 90s and 2000s, you have this combination of within churches, youth group leaders, preachers really promoting these sermons, these messages, these youth rallies around purity, around sexual abstinence. And purity is a key word, too. We can talk about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. And then this kind of bleeds over into public education as well. We talk about, Julia, you and I talk about, you don't have to have grown up in the church to have been screwed over by the church in this regard.
Because it's a wider cast.
all 50 states, exactly, all 50 states accept funding from the U.S. government in the last 30 years regarding sexual abstinence information.
What is also really important is to remember that purity culture is far more than the script around certain sexual behaviors. We recently did a podcast with Dr. Laura Anderson, who's a fellow therapist focusing on the intersection of religion, gender, and sexuality. And when we interviewed her, she described her own growing up experience and how for many people, purity culture was so prescriptive that it dictated far more than relationships with the opposite gender. It dictated what you wore. It dictated how you interacted with friends. It dictated who you could have as friends. And ultimately, for many people, especially girls and women, contributed to this pervasive culture of anxiety. And I would actually say fear and dread for so many people.
Yeah, and especially girls and women, and it impacts boys in different ways too, but this is something that especially impacts folks who are currently in their 30s and their 40s, very much a millennial generation. Like we were the target audience for the content from purity culture, everything from True Love Waits. Who are some of the other kind of,
wasn't there some kind of movement for, I think, especially for girls to, I forgot what the verb is, but to re-virginize themselves or something?
Oh, yes. Born again virginity, which is very familiar to me because I grew up in a Baptist church. And so being born again is one of the prime tenets of being a Christian in that community. And so they're applying the language that the Baptist Church has on salvation. Being born again, it means that you have salvation. And so then they apply that to virginity, which we could also describe as a rigid view of what sexuality actually is. When purity culture talks about sex, they are often referring to very specific types of penetrative intercourse, which has all kinds of implications for gender as well. So yes, to answer your question, the born again virginity is pretty strong language that would suggest that virginity is also an important part of your literal salvation between heaven and hell. And my community of religion was a little bit different from Jeremiah's. And I grew up with a lot of fear of going to hell. And my sexuality was deeply tied to whether or not I would go to hell.
So how did you end up, I mean, each of you, I'm guessing you have, you know, your own two different stories, but how'd you end up getting out of that?
So gradually for me, there's a couple of stages that happened. I think that there was a cognitive shift that happened for me in graduate school. I went to my graduate degree is in marriage and family therapy. And I actually went to Abilene Christian, which is a evangelical Christian school in West Texas. And for me, the first way out was learning about systems theory. Learning about the interconnectedness of everything. And then also reading folks like Jacques Lacan, Michel Foucault, and recognizing how structures and organizations enforce like particular messages for their own good, and like recognizing the ways that happened in the church. So back up a little bit. For me, therapy is actually a second career. My first career is in music ministry. So I went to graduate school while I was also working at a 2000 person church in West Texas. And, so there was a cognitive understanding of what was going on. I moved to Boston 12, 13 years ago and was hoping to kind of be able to slip out of it. One of the ways that my ex-wife and I tried to find a sense of belonging and community was through the church. Like that's all that we knew. And so we find another church, we get plugged in. I end up leading worship at the church for another 6 years after that. And about that time, I started taking courses in sex therapy. So my journey into sex therapy is not particularly glamorous. I was working at a private practice, and my boss, Stephen Duclos, said, "Hey, Jeremiah, I know that you're interested in becoming a couples therapist. I'm starting a training in sex therapy. Do you want to be a part of this? I will subsidize some of it for you." I'm like, sweet, that sounds great. And what I learned in sex therapy training was all the stuff about sexuality that I had missed. I was 30 years old the first time that I had a conversation about what consent was and how to practice it.
Wow.
And began realizing, oh my gosh, like, I've been married since I was 24. My sexual relationship is already fraught for a myriad of reasons, mostly connected with purity culture. And so that really began to shape and reshape the way that I thought about all sorts of things. I ended up getting fired from my church, largely connected with me being a sex therapist and talking about it and encouraging other folks in the church to talk about it and thinking it was a safe place to talk about sexuality when it actually wasn't. And then I got divorced 6 months later. Mm. And that was a very, I say that I was kicked out of the church. That's the easiest way to describe it. Uh-huh. So some of it was choices that I made, but also some of it was choices that other people made too, and then having to then figure out how to make sense of all of this. And my work with Sex Evangelicals with Julia has been really healing for me in helping to make sense of, wow, what just happened in the last 5 years of my life, but also the last 35 years of my life. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah, Julia, how would you tell your story?
The beginning of it is a little bit similar to Jeremiah. I would say that going to Christian college was actually my journey out of a formal institutionalized Christianity. I also went to a Christian college in Michigan, Calvin College. I'm sure I can say it. I've got some great things to say about them.
They're not inviting you back.
I have to say, wait, just utter coincidence. This is hilarious. The letter, we make up names for the letters. You know, we don't use the real names. We change the names. Our letter writer, we called Calvin. Maybe we should change that name. It happened to be called Calvin. So
We'll keep it.
That's just a complete coincidence, just for our listeners to know that. So go ahead. Yes.
That's funny. So I went to Calvin College for my undergraduate degree, and my bachelor's degree is in social work, similarly to what Jeremiah mentioned. The introduction for me to sociology and systems theory allowed me to unlearn so much of what I had been taught, and I'll actually say was indoctrinated with in my growing up years around humanity in general. The sexual messages stayed with me pretty deep. And that's something anecdotally that I've noticed with clients too, that people might move out of fundamentalist communities, but those early messages around sexuality, gender, and relationships are often the ones that are most difficult to unlearn and relearn.
I see that in my practice too, actually. And I don't, of course, I don't specialize in that, but I do see that.
And I got married when I was 22, which is very young. And I am divorced. My ex-husband is a phenomenal human being. So I will always say that. But what I learned growing up around sexuality, I would say, was actually one of the most significant factors that ultimately led to divorce. After being married, my ex-husband and I did see a sex therapist. It took us a couple years to see a sex therapist because we lived in Columbus, Ohio, which does not have great sexual health resources. So by the time we moved to Boston and met with a phenomenal sex therapist, we had multiple years of really poor patterns and communication around sexuality, which is pervasive to the rest of the relationship. Sure. And we met with this lovely woman. She was so, so helpful. I think about her often, and I believe that I am a better person for being in therapy with her. But ultimately, we didn't get the support that we needed fast enough. Mm. And as I started leaving Christianity, the foundation that my husband and I had around Christianity was no longer there. That's ultimately what brought us together. And when I made choices to move outside of that religious context, we didn't have anything else to support us.
Yeah, interesting. You know, I'm thinking as you're describing your experiences, you know, you probably know from our podcast, we're Jewish. And actually, we've interviewed Batsheva Marcus. Do you know her?
No.
No.
Yeah, she is. She's known as the Orthodox sex guru.
Oh, I am writing that down.
Yeah, check her out. You might want to have her on your podcast, actually. She's a lot of fun.
She's great.
And she grew up Orthodox, but she's very much not fundamentalist. And I was kind of, you know, comparing and contrasting. Judy and I grew up Jewish, but not Orthodox. We kind of came from traditional backgrounds, but not like Orthodox backgrounds. And even among Orthodox, I mean, for example, I mean, one of our kids is modern Orthodox. And the interesting thing about modern Orthodox is they are often very much not fundamentalist also. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me hearing the differences, you know, among the folks that Batsheva works with often, she will be sent very fundamentalist folks from the Hasidic world or the yeshivish world, the sort of ultra-Orthodox would be the term that they don't usually like, but that's
like the Jewish equivalent of evangelical types that you grew up with.
With one big difference, and it's interesting, the one similarity I was noticing was that sense of us versus them is very much there in a lot of groups, different groups to mm-hmm. different extents. But it's interesting because they tend to be within marriage, quite sex positive, but completely ignorant. And that's a lot of what Batsheva deals with is folks who got no education at all. They have no clue. And they are thrown together at marriage, given a little bit of information by folks often who don't know much themselves, and expected to have it be just okay. And of course, it doesn't work out well. And so there's a lot of overlap there.
I'm thinking about a friend of mine, and I won't say her name. She's given me permission to share this story, though. She and her partner got married very, very young, and they were having some sexual struggles. And they also just didn't know. When I say didn't know anything, that's really not an exaggeration. And she was telling me, on her honeymoon, they were just totally lost. And so they started Googling floor play because they had heard something about floor play and thought it was floor play. And years later, she was like, how did that happen? Yes, it's a very real thing. And we laugh and cry about it depending on the day.
Now I got to look up floor play. I'll bet it exists, of course. Yeah, right. No, that is, yeah, and that is the kind of thing, again, sounds like, you know, similar stories. You know, it's so interesting because the thing about, well, I'll tell you another thing. It's one of my sort of shticks is, you know, the reason we call our podcast Couples Therapy in 7 words. The 7 words are be kind, don't panic, and have faith. And I'm always at pains to say, you know, when I say have faith, the way I define faith is actually the opposite of fundamentalism. Reality has a very much, I would claim, reality pushes toward faith, not fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is a sense in which, you know, you already know the answers to everything and you're not paying any attention to anything that doesn't fit that, which is the opposite of what I call faith.
Right. Faith is lumped in this idea of not knowing.
Yeah, exactly.
Of being curious, of non-judgmentality, then you can access a completely different set of characteristics than you can around fundamentalism. And one of the double binds of fundamentalism, at least as it's practiced in American Christianity, is there's an expectation in fundamentalism that you know, that you're supposed to know things, and yet the church doesn't teach you anything about sexuality. It teaches you very little about how to do healthy communication. And so you have people like me who come along and turn 30 and are getting sex education for the first time. And then there's, on an individual level, like there's all sorts of like shame and anxiety, like and rage actually that came up for me. Like, why didn't I learn about this beforehand? And from a relational level, like that also messes with the relationship dynamic too. Because while I was like invested in learning about sexuality, my ex-wife wasn't going to the sex therapy program that I had. And so now we have two people in a relationship in which is already sexual anxiety. And one person is getting all of this information about sexuality, and the other person doesn't have that information, which doubles down on that other person's shame. And that was for the two of us, that was the dynamic we weren't able to overcome. And that happens with a lot of couples where one person gets access to sexuality, sexual exploration through numerous sources at a different rate from their partner. And that can cause a lot of strife and turmoil.
Oh, yeah. And I'm imagining not merely, you know, the discrepancy in what knowledge you have, but the difference in the idea of how speakable it is. Do you know what I mean? That what's so crucial in, you know, that's what we all say to our, or well, many of us, I guess, say to our clients is how important it is to render sexuality and, you know, what you like, what you don't like, what you might, you're not sure if you like, all of that, render that speakable. And that's often more of a problem than what knowledge you have. If it's speakable, you can find out the, you know, the knowledge, you can explore it, you can play. But if you're terrified by the whole concept of even talking about it, or if one party is and the other party isn't, it becomes very difficult to bridge that gap.
We are just finishing next week our last episode in this series called The Seven Deadly Sexual Sins According to the Church. And the prelude of it, not even a sin, but the prelude was don't talk about sex.
Right.
So I'm hearing what you're saying and also reflecting on how so many problems occur in all kinds of communities, not just fundamentalist Christian communities, when we aren't able to give language to sexuality. Sex therapy is such a complicated thing.
Yeah.
And one of the many facets of it is allowing a vulnerable topic to be in the room, to be spoken about explicitly with kindness, and to your motto, with hopefully a low degree of panic, and a therapist can hopefully facilitate that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting how I've told this story, I think, before. I was at a training not too long ago, and it was for couples therapists, not specifically sex therapists. I'm not trained as a sex therapist, just couples therapist. And so this was like, it was on Zoom. There was like 100 some people there. And they did a little poll. The trainer did a little poll. How many of you ask about a couple's sex life, or, you know, there's, if they have any, whatever their sexual issues might be, in the, you know, the first couple of sessions? And I'm sitting there thinking, well, come on, obviously we all do, don't we? And I think it was 30 or 40% do. It's like a substantial majority do not. People were saying things, no, I'll wait till they bring it up. And I'm thinking, holy cow, you're afraid to talk about sex. I mean, I shouldn't leap to that conclusion immediately.
But. Yeah, and there's research studies that have been done, Bruce, that kind of talk about that too, about how, what a low percentage of people who do couples therapy ask about sex therapy, ask about a couple's sexual relationship throughout the course of couples therapy. So there's a dearth of conversation of it inside the church, but also outside of the church as well. So
I'll even note, you know, that one thing occurs to me as you were saying, I think, Julie, as you were talking about, you know, the issue of talking about it, that I've noticed even in progressive circles there are ways in which you know, particularly in the world of sexuality, where somebody might have some fantasies that just are not politically correct.
Yep.
And they just can't, in some, as they say, sort of, we live in Vermont, it's a really politically very progressive sort of state. And it is amazing how people can get stuck in ideology on the left, right, and center.
Yeah.
This is not exclusive to, you know, fundamentalist Christians, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a good time for us to go to our listener question.
Great.
Perfect. Calvin.
Calvin. Tell me about Calvin.
Good old Calvin.
You know, I wonder if that subconsciously stuck in my mind after listening to your podcast. So
that's possible.
The name.
Could be.
All right. So Calvin writes, "Dear Dr. Chalmer, I was reading your new book and I saw that one of the couples you mentioned, Alfie and Alexis, Sounds an awful lot like Amelia and I. I'm 27 years old and married to Amelia for 2 years. She is 23. We both grew up in conservative evangelical homes and have the same values and dreams. I'm training to be a deacon in our church. My problem is that I'm attracted to men. I knew I always was. When I turned 18, I went to talk about it with my minister. He assured me that it's normal for some men to feel that way, but once we got married and saw how beautiful a woman is, those thoughts would go away. After 2 years, the thoughts have not gone away. In our church, homosexuality is a sin, and if I tell them I'm a homosexual, I will be excommunicated from the church, and it would ruin our families. We both have pretty large families that have been in that church for generations. If I come out, I will be ruining so many lives. Should I stay in my marriage to keep the peace and try to be a good husband to Amelia? She's a great gal, and I would hate to destroy her life, especially because we just found out she's pregnant. Ouch.
Oh.
So.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Huge hug to Calvin and Amelia. This sounds like a really awful, tough situation. So.
Yeah, this is
heartbreaking.
And even writing the email to you speaks to so much bravery, whatever he and his family decides to do.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm always impressed with that. You know, and I see the same thing in the office. Folks will come in with things that's like, wow, that took an enormous amount of courage just to recognize you want to talk to somebody. And people know when they're talking to me, I am very much not, I'm not Christian. I mean, I'm known in Vermont as a Jewish guy. You know, I'm very active in the Jewish community. And they know that, but I'm always impressed when people do that.
Yeah.
So that's when we said this is right up your alley. This is right up your alley. So how do we let Calvin? Where do you start with this? I mean, you know, he's right. This is going to ruin so many lives.
I'll start by saying, aside from all the empathy in the entire world, that the reality is that he's stuck between some bad choices.
Yeah.
When I completed my sex therapy training at U of M, two of many things have stood out to me. One is that sex therapy is always about grief and loss. And whatever Calvin decides to do, the path will include grief and loss.
Yep.
The other part that's coming to mind from one of the professors was that often in sex therapy, we are stuck between some difficult choices, and we only have hard choices to make.
David Schnarch calls this the two-choice dilemma.
So I have hope for Calvin, but this is a choice that includes grief and loss on both sides.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because ultimately this is a choice about how to engage himself in his sexuality within the context of systems, families, and communities.
Yeah. That's so interesting. It is, you know, I hadn't thought of it that way, that sex therapy always involves grief and loss. That's a great way of thinking about it. You know, that what are they doing there? They're doing there because something is difficult. And as I so often point out to the folks I work with, of course, it's difficult. If it were easy, you know, the folks who come to see me are generally speaking quite intelligent, and they could have figured it out if it was easy, and it's not. The reason it's hard is that it's hard.
Yeah.
Do you find that the church, you know, you've had, when they come up against homosexuality, like, do they do with the pray away the gay, that type of thing?
Depending on the community. What I'm also hearing in the letter, not having the privilege of a full conversation, part of him, at least part of him, if I'm hearing this correctly, would like to pursue other forms of sexuality.
Yeah.
And or other types of sexual experiences. If he chooses to make that choice, he's also being fairly explicit about what the consequences are. And of course, I would want to believe everyone, but both intellectually and then within my own experience, I'm sitting with what he will lose if he chooses to make other sexual choices or other sexual experiences.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about the role of secrets. And Calvin individually is already describing holding a lot of secrets as an individual. And being really curious about, for Calvin, what the difference would be for Calvin keeping a secret individual, and like, who is he protecting in that process? Probably protecting Amelia, probably protecting other folks in his family. And moving that secret from an individual secret to, at least for the time being, a couple secret.
Yes.
That's the, and that's where a good couples therapy, I think, could come in, that a couples therapy, say someone like myself or Julia, to be able to hold on to the space of Calvin communicating everything from fantasy to exploring what the word homosexuality means. For starters, Julia and I don't use the word homosexuality. We use the word queerness. Homosexuality has kind of moved into a bit of a dog whistle type of term that only conservatives use these days.
Interesting that
I suspect that's why he used it.
Yes.
And part of understanding queerness is also like recognizing some of the shame and naming some of the homophobia, and then recognizing as a couple in the and being okay, like having this like secretive couples therapy almost. How can Calvin and Calvin and Amelia together begin to sit with some of the beliefs that they have that they've been taught about queerness, and to think in different ways, independent from pressures from their families, things like that, just to create a sense of alliance and to see to what capacity there is a sense of alliance between Calvin and Amelia.
Yeah, I was thinking that we don't know Amelia, or if he has shared anything with Amelia, if the relationship has the trust in which he could talk with Amelia about this, like Jeremiah said, in the context of couples therapy. I think that there could be a challenging and also really beautiful alliance to decide what they want to do. And something that I would want to ask both of them, but since Calvin is the letter writer, I would want to ask him what he wants, which sounds like a very basic question, but I remember being in individual therapy and I had been fantasizing about divorce. And eventually that was something that I brought into couples therapy with my ex-husband, but I talked about it for the first time in individual therapy. And my therapist asked me, well, what do you want? And that was a mind-blowing question, because I was 28 at the time and nobody had asked me what I had ever wanted.
Yeah.
And in fundamentalist communities, that is very rarely ever a question that someone gets asked or asks another person.
Yeah.
And I'm realizing that without other information, I've got some ideas about what Calvin might want, but I don't know. So is Calvin fantasizing about divorce? Does he want to like go to a gay club three states away for the weekend where like no one's going to see him and just like know that that's okay? And like nobody's going to report that. Does he want to explore something else? But I'd be really curious about that for Calvin.
Yeah.
I gotta believe, obviously we don't know him. I'm guessing he, just as a general principle, I'll bet he wants a bunch of different things that are often in conflict. You know, my impression of the letter, and again, as you say, it's like we haven't talked to him. My impression of the letter is he's wanting not to keep secrets, but he's realizing, as you point out, he's realizing the ramification if he were to come out. And that is, I think that is the term he used. If I come out, what that would be explosive. And he's hoping to not have to explode. You know, he doesn't want to hurt his wife. He doesn't want to hurt his families. But he also clearly it's not working for him to be the person he is in that situation.
Well, and this gets back to the grief that Julia is talking about. From our perspective, for religious, for folks who grew up in conservative fundamentalist religious communities, talking about sexuality in and of itself moves you a little bit out of the church community and kind of puts you in that church choice dilemma. So in the case of Calvin, if I choose, even if I start talking with myself, with Amelia about like what the... how I might be able to explore sexuality in this particular way, like that is inherently moving him out of the church community. Like, the hard thing is, like, there's no way around that. And I think
the Orthodox Jewish expression for that would be going off the derech. Derech means way in Hebrew. It's going off the path. It's like, as soon as you go there, you're already off the path, you know?
Right.
Well, you're reading the letter. I had written down that Calvin said that he and Amelia have the same values. I would want to know what those values are. And in sex therapy, I often always differentiate between what are the values and what are the behaviors. Many communities, particularly Christian communities, conflate those two things, right? For example, purity culture, they claim as a value, but really defined by behavior. And the point that I'm trying to make with that is that it would be helpful with Calvin, hopefully with Amelia present, to talk about what the values are, and then from those values make a decision. So, and I think we all, or any therapist, would need to be careful to protect Calvin's autonomy, because there's a part of me, the part of me that left a religious community and have experienced a lot of freedom, that it would be very easy for me to like want or even like push that for Calvin. When I got divorced in my life, I lost my family, and it was a very awful time for me. I also had a good job, and I had some friends who weren't going to leave me, and I had what some people don't have. And so maybe Calvin would get divorced and choose to live with those consequences and have the relationships and the experiences that he would want. Maybe he and Amelia do talk together, and maybe they make some sort of arrangement for him to have other sexual experiences that can stay a secret. Secrets aren't great, but we have to realize that he may or may not want or be willing to lose the families and the status that he has built. And ultimately, our job is to help him explore his values, and then from the values, talk about the options that he has, and then for him to take the lead on what are those options, and what are the hard choices that I'm going to make to pursue potential options. Because there are, it's not an all or nothing thing. It might be an all or nothing thing, but it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing.
Well, and Julia, what you're bringing up about the distinction between values and behaviors is really important. Because the church has, the conservative church has the perspective that, to use their language, quote, homosexuality is a value. Homosexuality isn't actually a value. It's an orientation. It's a series of behaviors. Julia, what you're talking about with values, like compassion, that's a value. Honesty, that's a value. Adventurousness, that's a value. Creativity. You know, those are values are adjectives, are descriptor terms, and so moving Calvin and Amelia in that direction, like, what are the types of interactions that you want to have? Like, that's a good way to get us into that. Then homosexuality, queerness, whatever language that you want to use,
right? Because maybe the volume of compassion would lead in all sorts of options. And I can say, okay, so you and Amelia, you've got the value of compassion. That's a beautiful value. Okay, what are some implications of that value? What choices do you have from the value of compassion?
Right.
And like I said at the beginning, those choices are probably all going to be hard choices. None of them are going to be easy choices. But in order to also get out of the panic, because I love the be kind, don't panic part, moving out of behaviors and moving out of choices initially to look at values can also like de-escalate some of the anxiety that is understandably and rightfully high. When I was in my own version of that, which is a different version, it was very panic inducing. And so it would be easy for me to say, well, don't panic, you will survive. You know, that's not a helpful thing probably to hear when you are feeling anxious, but if there are some questions to ask that can de-escalate some of that anxiety, that could be helpful as well.
One of the things I like to point out a lot with folks in similar kinds of dilemmas is And it's funny, he mentioned my book. I wrote about a couple in the book that was facing a rather similar thing. And it was, and of course, the couples in my book are composites. They're not the actual people I work with, but I have run into people in similar kinds of scenarios. And one of the things I note is, first of all, there is a real pull on me to enforce my own ideologies. You know what I mean? And you were pointing that out. You know, I could say, well, of course you should, you know, you should be the person that you are, and you need to, you know, have autonomy, and, you know, you're in an oppressive environment and you should get out of it. And of course, my doing that would not help them at all, especially with folks who are saying they are very much a part of that church and committed to it. And not for me to say, oh no, leave your church, leave. So, you know, that's important to them too. But also I note there are lots of stories I'll hear of folks who are coming out in various ways where the reactions of their family isn't exactly as bad as they might have thought. Sometimes it's worse, but sometimes it's surprising. And so, and I realize they can't necessarily predict that in advance, but it isn't always so clear just because, you know, they grew up in evangelical church, but that doesn't mean everybody's going to respond exactly the same way. And so that's a factor as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a couple of coming out processes. There's the coming out process that individually is happening with Calvin as he's coming to terms. And again, big hugs to Calvin for some of the ways that he tried to seek out help and the way that initiation was received by whoever he reached out to. There's also the coming out process within the couple. And that's really, really important. And that process may take years to be able to work through and to be able to talk through as comprehensively as possible what the implications of being attracted to men, decisions around what Calvin does or doesn't choose to pursue regarding that. Then and only then can we talk about the family. And how do we then communicate that to the family? I would be really, really, I would take a position that the most important relationship right now is the relationship between you and Amelia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to really take the work and the time to be as aligned as they can.
Yeah. And it sounds like a very loving relationship. We don't know, but it, I had that impression, right or wrong. And maybe that's because I really hope it to be. And something that I often tell my clients that the church misses is that I only place a value on your flourishing as a human being.
Yeah.
I don't place a value on the outcome of your behaviors or choices. That's important to me as a value, particularly because the church tends to prioritize institutions and dogma over the flourishing of people. So if Calvin and or Calvin and Amelia were in the room, what I would want them to know is I want you to flourish as human beings individually. And if you choose together in a partnership, that's your choice. And I am not tied to the outcome. I'm only tied to your humanity.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like Calvin should be in touch with you guys.
And we
that's
don't know.
Recommendation, Calvin.
There's also thousands, if not tens of thousands, of relationships that are similar to Calvin's.
Yeah. Well, I think that less as I was saying, Calvin, contact Jeremiah and Julia and keep in touch and let us know how things go.
So how should people, in terms of getting in touch with you, I mean, tell us, like, how could people find your podcast? How could they find the two of you if they wanted to work with you? Tell us, like, a website we should put in the notes, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so for folks who are interested in engaging with us, we suggest that you start with our podcast, Sex Evangelicals, and that's on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, a whole bunch of other podcasting host sites that I had never heard of. Start with episode 58, which is the first in our current series entitled The Seven Deadly Sexual Sins According to the Church. In episode 58, we talk about sin number one, which is don't have sex before you get married. And this is one of the cornerstones of evangelical purity culture. And sadly, as we talked about, so many folks experience great pain from the precedents that this, quote, sin sets for sexuality and for relationships.
And even though our niche is for folks who, for folks, particularly partnerships from fundamentalist types of backgrounds. As Jeremiah was mentioning at the beginning when he was discussing purity culture, the marriage between evangelicalism and political parties has shaped the sex education, and I would say lack of sex education in the United States. Right. And so even if you haven't grown up in the communities in which we did, we hope that our work could be helpful in redefining an ethic around sexuality that includes consent and mutual pleasure and far more than the disservice that most people receive from their communities, whether that be a restrictive religious community or the public school system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we write about this as well on our website, www.sexevangelicals.com. We have a blog and all of our podcast episodes are there. And then Julia and I are also both on Instagram and Twitter at sexvangelicals.
So yes, that is our plug for ourselves.
Yes.
Okay, well, good.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's been delightful to have you on.
Thank you all for having us on the show.
Jeremiah, we have a bit of a division of labor with the podcast. And Jeremiah, I believe, mentioned that you had reached out to him via
Podmatch.
Said, oh, here's this match that I received. I was like, oh, I recognize that name. I did one of his trainings and I'm a type A student, but I was very behind on my CEUs. So I was scrambling and I don't usually scramble. And I I loved yours. And that's what I said to you.
I'm delighted.
His training was great.
Was that the one where we dressed up as characters?
Yeah, we showed videos, I think, of us enacting some of the couples in my earlier book. I think.
Yes.
Funny.
Yes. It was really great. So I was excited when Jeremiah told me about the match.
Well, I'm delighted with that as well.
Oh, good. I'm glad you went and had the training. I'm glad you liked it.
So it was really good. And then it was fun too. I didn't know that you had a podcast and it's been fun to listen to your episodes after we connected.
Well, yeah, I've been listening to your podcast. I highly recommend it to anybody, everybody, not just evangelicals.
Thank you.
Really wonderful. Yeah, really kind.
Well, thanks a lot.
Well, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as we enjoyed interviewing Julia and Jeremiah.
We had a great time interviewing them and really interesting folks. Mm-hmm. I was noting that sort of parallel, from our Jewish experience.
Yeah.
We didn't grow up in fundamentalist backgrounds mm-hmm. at all, but know folks who have. Mm-hmm. And there's some interesting similarities and differences
Very
there.
Very much
and
so.
I really enjoyed what Julia had to say about, this is not just evangelical Christians that are dealing with a lot of these very sort of closed attitudes about sex, especially.
Mm-hmm. I like the advice that they had for our listener question, for mm-hmm. Calvin's question, things that I had never even thought about. So that's what a good marriage or couples therapist and sex therapist will give you a good perspective on that. So,
absolutely.
So, yeah.
Well, great. So before we conclude today, I just want to put in another word for my most recent book, the number one bestseller in its category, which is...
It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
And you can get, you can find that anywhere books are sold, but the simplest way, I think, is just go to brucechalmer.com or you can go to ctn7.com and there's a books tab on there mm-hmm. and it'll send you right to brucechalmer.com. We've got you coming and going, folks.
There you go. All our websites.
So please do that and get a hold of the book. And we had somebody write in who said, this was somebody who I hadn't seen in years, wrote in and said how much they enjoyed it and said, I bought 20 copies and I'm giving it to, she's giving it to all her friends.
Yes, because you helped them so much when you were their therapist.
Yes, indeed. So that was the sort of thing, as you can well imagine, it tickles me pink to get an email like that. I got a couple of those in the last few days, actually.
Yeah, I know. That's great.
Yeah.
So people are coming out of the woodworks, all your old clients that you've helped so much. So
yeah. So that's delightful. Mm-hmm. And so we hope you will go ahead and do that. And Also, as I mentioned earlier in our intro, sign up for my newsletter. Sign up for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter, and you will get, every couple of weeks, you'll get a nice newsy sort of newsletter. What I have in there is I have a tip of, you know, today's tip, relationship tip, which I hope you'll find interesting. Of course, I invite you also to submit your own, and maybe I'll put them in the newsletter.
Yeah.
I also have what I call What's the Big Idea? One of my favorite ideas to talk about, and I go into it rather briefly and much more informally than I do like in the books. And I also have some news and schmooze, whatever's coming up. So sign up for that as well. And so until next time.
Remember, be kind.
Don't panic.
And have faith.